Off the ball
on News Talk
in association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
You're very welcome along to our Saturday panel for this week. Joining me this afternoon are a man who's struggling not to call Mr. St. Pat's at this stage because pretty much doing everything bar doing the washing up down the kitchen. It's Ger O'Brien. You're very welcome to the show. Former Manchester City, Sunderland, and Ireland striker Stephen Elliott's here with us as well.
How's Stephen,
you're very welcome. And our Steady Mail's sports correspondent, Philip Quinlan, is here too.
Wearing City Blue, Richie. Wearing City Blue.
Did you know this was going to be coming up, that you're basically trying to lick up to Stephen while you're here? Or
well, I heard Stephen was coming in as a former City guy. He's way up in my books, but I didn't realise when I put on myself my short sleeved top, which you can only wear if you're over 50, that actually it was Sky Blue.
Or Joe Malloy.
Or Joe Malloy. And City actually kept winning 2-0, more of which none.
Yeah,
there you go.
First things first, I didn't know you're a Manchester City supporter, so that's kind of, you know, temper things is probably too strong a word at this stage.
Which, temporary?
Tempered things.
Oh, tempered, it is tempered, yeah, it is. I won't tell you how far back I go, but I was actually, last night I was saying, if Richie asked me that question today, will I recite the Man City team that won the Cup in 69? And I started to do it in my head.
You probably could.
And I actually got about 9 of them. I went, Quinner, stop it right there. But I'll go back that far. I'm just going to say that aside to Stephen, when City has changed an awful lot. I remember when they were rubbish and used to lose to Lincoln and things like that, and the old league, what was Division 3 is now League 1. And I kind of miss those days a little bit, because it's almost like you were saying there, Stephen, I was at the Cup Final against Sunderland.
Yeah,
I
was at the League Cup Final there a few years ago. Sunderland against City, and yeah. I was just taken back, like, you know, when you're walking down Wembley Way, there was nothing but Sunderland fans there, because obviously it was a massive day out for them. They hadn't been to a Cup Final in ages, and there wasn't a City fan in sight. And I'm thinking to myself, geez, how things have changed. Yeah. Like, at my time at City, like, they very rarely reach Wembley. I remember the playoff final, remember against Gillingham. I was at that game, and it was like just kind of City fans everywhere, and it was pure excitement. And I felt that day it was like there was expectancy on the City fans, and it felt like they were kind of just turning up. Like, even though the team and the fans, I think, have kind of come a little bit complacent and got used to winning, which we're saying to them outside, that's probably comes with winning trophies, that you kind of expect to win trophies. But it was just, it kind of clicked in my head. I thought, geez, how time can change things.
Well, somebody literally just before we came into the studio, somebody had posted a picture in relation to something else. I think they were interviewing Bernardo. It was Jack Pitbrook had interviewed Bernardo Silva, and he posted a picture in relation to some conversation that was ongoing, and it was a picture of Andy Morrison, who was a member of that side as well. He may be familiar with.
Yeah, I remember Andy.
He was a good eater.
He didn't miss dinner for a while.
Yeah, I remember the big thing about Andy Morrison is, remember Paolo Wanchope? The two of them had a fight in the training ground one time. Yeah. The two of them literally locked themselves into one of the rooms, like, because they had a bit of a spat. So Andy Morrison said to Wanchope, come on, we'll go and sort her out inside. And right enough, the two of them went in and had a right go over in the boot room. Now, I don't know who came out on top. I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure you can remember.
Come on.
Well, look at mouthful stuff. Who's the first person?
Well, the two of them are big lads, like, but yeah. I think Morrison might have kind of got him in a bear hug or something. But no, he was a big boy, Morrison. But he's still kind of remembered very fondly, I think, at City, you know, even though we played during them kind of days, but you remembered, like, down in the kind of Division 3 and that. But
there is a certain warmth that goes along with players who have been with a club through, the players who guide them through the troubled times, essentially, are always, they always get a certain deal of reverence associated with them. I mean, you probably have seen a couple of them, the clubs you've been at as well, Ger. Not only with Pats, but elsewhere. You see those players that things may have been a little bit grim for the club, or, you know, for the team in general, but those ones who stuck by them and tried to help them out as best they could and put in, as John Giles might say, the honesty of effort kind of goes a long way.
Yeah, I think fans can kind of identify with that. And, you know, clubs can go full circle, you know, when they're winning things and things are going great for them, and then all of a sudden, you know, when difficult time comes, you see lads jumping ship and going for bigger contracts or for, you know, better clubs at that given time. But, you know, I think they can identify with those type of players, and, you know, it can work both ways. You know, those players can be the ones that are on the brunt of, you know, a lot of the frustration and the stick as well. But when they come through it, you know, Lucas Levia would have got a lot at Liverpool at the beginning, but he obviously stuck through, and, you know, he came nearly like a little cult hero at the end. And, you know, I think every club
just had to see him go, weren't
they? Yeah, I think most Liverpool fans would have been, but I think a lot of clubs around the world would have, you know, one or two players in their group that would be like that.
Who are the Pats ones at the minute, though?
Apart from Ger.
Well, obviously things aren't going too well this season, but we still have a, you know, just likes myself and Christy Fagan and Ian Birmingham, people, Conan Bourne, people like that, that are still at the club. And, you know, sometimes it's a little unfair because you're probably immune to the criticism because people can remember the good things that you've done. But, you know, it's I think it's just part and parcel of the game nowadays.
What's the mood like at Pats at the minute? Because it's not been a good year. It's not been an easy year on a number of fronts.
No, it's not been easy, to be honest with you. you know, over the last kind of two seasons, we would have seen probably our better players being cherry picked with the likes of Cork and Dundalk. And, you know, just speaking outside to Stephen about the likes of Jamie McGrath, Sean Hoare, they would have came through our scholarship programme, Manute, and we would have put a lot of time and effort in. But just where they were in their career and what Dundalk could offer them, they probably needed to go to make the next step. And the fact we'd know European football this season because of where we finished last year has obviously hurt us in attracting players. And, you know, you take the Bray situation as well, where they were able to offer better contracts to players where we probably would have got, you know, some of those guys this season. It's kind of compounded the fact that we were blooding through a lot of young players because of the budget and stuff like that. So, listen, we'll be judged at the end of the season where we finish. But the mood's okay at the moment.
It's the lack of being able to plan long term for any club, no matter who you are, whether you're Shamrock Rovers, whether you're Dundalk at the minute, so probably have a little bit of leeway. But if you're in that morass that's down below the third and it's down towards 12th in the league, you kind of are struggling to see where the next, like, I mean, you've seen it draw it as well. Mm. You kind of struggle to see where 2-3 years down the line the club is going to be. There's just a case of survival, I suppose, almost. Yeah,
well, I think going to a draw is a situation like they kind of got promoted last year, probably unexpectedly, and it's a very young squad there. And I think the big step up has probably been so far a little bit too much to ask from the lads, but it's still a very young team there. And it might kind of stand them in good stead going forward, because I said that's the thing, like you say, you can't really, like, not many clubs in Ireland can say, there you go, there's a player there, you kind of walk with them for the next 2-3 years, get a kind of plan in place, like what kind of Cork City, Dundalk have done. They kind of, you can tell their teams are well drilled now, they play together and they have a way of playing and they have an identity. And it's very difficult for other clubs to kind of create that amongst the squads when they don't know what players are going to be there from 1 year to the next.
Mm. Philip, you've kind of seen this all come and go over the past number of years, let's just say.
Well, I think League of Ireland at the moment actually is quite strong. I really do. I think there's a bit of a gap between sort of the haves and the have-nots. And with the European money, which is colossal, and, you know, Jeremy being aware of that, when he mentioned Pat's not in European football, it's a huge, the incentives to get into Europe, particularly to win the Champions League, into the Champions League, it's something like over €500,000 now for a club. You know, it's irrespective of the prize money you get from the sort of sponsors of the FAI, wherever it is, the League of Ireland prize money. It's the UEFA carrot, which is huge.
It's the scale of it is completely away from what they get domestically.
It's distorted. It actually is distorted. And if you get there, as Dundalk have done, they've won the league last
3 years.
3 years. Cork are going to do it now. They're almost there, and they've been in Europe. So Cork are now going to get €500,000 plus next year, and they'll be able to reinvest and get the best players to come along. And you'll see, I think, Dundalk and Cork continue to push away. I was at Rovers last night, and they've got to the cup semi-final, and I think for Irish club football, it would be good if Rovers got to the final and actually won the cup final. And that might, they're not a million miles off. Sure, they're not a million miles off the top two. But, you know, it's interesting because in Dublin at the moment, and Jerry, we've been there for the good days of Pat's winning leagues and the FAI Cup. Dublin club football at the moment isn't as strong as it has been. And that's just one thing that I take a step back a little bit. Miss Shelburne badly in the top division. Pat's in a bit of a sort of a valley period at the moment. Bowes haven't challenged for a while. Dundalk and Cork could pull away, and I'm not necessarily if that's necessarily a good thing.
Is that not what people complained about for years, though? Is that ultimately the Dublin clubs, when we saw Bowes winning doubles, when we saw Shells competing in Europe, is that there was almost a moan that, you know, we need to kind of see it develop in the regions a little bit more?
You want a healthy mix. You want a bit of both. I mean, at the moment, it's kind of going a little bit away from what it was. I think football is cyclical, and we're going to talk about the Irish national team in a little while. And talks about troughs and peaks there, because I mean they've had more than anybody at the moment, a little bit of a dip. But Irish club football, I think in general, actually is not in bad shape. I think from a press box, facilities are much better than they were, particularly around Dublin. Pitches are better, and that's the FAI would be credited for that. I think there's more of an experience for fans to go actually watch it. There's a little bit of an identity thing, you know. But I have to say, I think on balance, the League of Ireland is in a better shape than it was a few years ago. Clubs they've curbed back on their mad spending. But the big issue is, it still comes down, the UEFA honeypot is so big, you get a slice of that and you're in a position to strengthen your squad and pull clear of the rest.
But do you not think football, like in general, obviously you've got the two teams now that have been strong over the last few years in the League of Ireland. Football swings and roundabouts, and everybody has their moments, like go through periods where they're strong, and it's like, although it's very difficult for other clubs outside them too at the moment, and it can be frustrating being one of their supporter of them clubs, because you're looking at all this team having other success. I think it makes football people and football fans of them clubs appreciate the success more when it comes, like, because I said, when you go a certain amount of time without having any success, you start to when you get a little bit of, like you mentioned there, Rovers not having done much in the last years, I'm sure if they win the cup, it'd bring a great feeling back around that club, and they may appreciate that a little bit more rather than taking stuff for granted.
It's always when the European draw comes around, and I say this as somebody of the black and red persuasion in Dublin, it's when the European draw comes around in whatever it is, July, August, and you're not in there. You kind of feel that pang of, because it's not necessarily at that point winning leagues or winning trophies, it's to be in contention and to show that you're actually knocking around the upper echelons of the league and you can prove yourself. It's that kind of thing that always gnaws at you as a fan, and I'm sure it does as a player and a coach as well, Ger.
It does, but when you look at it next year, when let's strip it back, there's going to be a 10-team league next year, and chances are there's going to be four of them 10 are going to get European places, because it's obviously three and then the cup, and normally what happens is one of the top three wins the cup, so four place get in. So you're talking 40% of your league, of your top league division, is going to be entering into European competitions. And just going back to a point, now the League of Ireland is different in the sense that years ago when I started playing first, it was teams. Everyone just had a senior team. You might have had a reserve team, then it was the under-21 league, and then it was down to the 19s. Now it's a club. It's gone. Every club has to feel like a club now. You've got senior teams, you've got 19s, you've got 17s, you've got 15s, you've got 13s. All of a sudden, we're making small strides to get to where the League of Ireland needs to be.
It's a cultural issue.
Yeah, there has to be an identity. All the clubs at this moment in time need to get their house in order in the sense of facilities and stuff like that. I know Philip said facilities are better, but from a playing perspective, they need to be way better. Like, dressing rooms need to be better, shower facilities need to be better.
There's some grounds that you're still essentially porta cabins.
there needs to be better.
This is a 5-hour long show.
It needs to be better for families to attract them, and because, and I've said this numerous times, how do we get more people into the grounds? If one of my daughters wants me to bring them to the cinema to see a princess film, I'll bring them because I have to, as an adult. They needs an adult to go
with
them.
You're a big
fan. And I'm a big fan. But kids are the ones. The adults have already made up their mind whether they want to go or not going to go. You're not going to turn the head of a 40-year-old man who's never been to a League of Ireland game. But it's the kids, it's that generation. So, listen, as an organisation, the FAI need to be doing a hell of a lot more, but so do the clubs. They need to take more responsibility as well.
Well, on that, what do the FAI need to be doing?
We need to put more investment into it. I think there needs to be a little bit more. I know from flipping to the other side now this season and seeing the other side of things, not the playing side, there needs to be more transparency, obviously, with the money that's coming in for the leagues. Can we attract a bigger sponsor if the money isn't coming in? I know the teams, the 12 Premier League teams, have been, you know, together and working towards making things better, but ultimately if we're not driving it forward as clubs, and I mean all 20 clubs, well then, you know, you're going to get this divide, because the ones that are going to continue to get into Europe are going to set the pace and get ahead, and if they spend it wisely, well then, there's going to be no catching them. But Stephen's right. Well, I remember in 2010, maybe Rovers got to the Europa League group stages. I think I was playing with Derry at the time. I remember thinking, with that money, there's no one going to touch them. But it happened so quickly. You know, the mismanagement of budgets, or bringing in the wrong players, or the blend doesn't happen for whatever reason, whether you're at the signing the best 20 players, it can change. And look what Stephen done up in Dundalk. Even 2012, he would have brought in players who people would have regarded as, you know, some okay first division players that aren't getting games for other the so-called top teams, and he made a group there, and he's actually creating a serious legacy now for people in Dundalk.
Coming back to the league as you did, like, what was your impression of it? Like, I'd imagine you had one impression coming in and quite another as soon as you had like four or five games back under your belt when you're at Shells in particular.
One thing I will say, the people like looking after the clubs, the lads that are coaching, managing, the people that like at the Rectors Club, they are trying, I think a lot of them, the majority of them are trying their best. Like, the effort that is put in behind the scenes is very, because there's a lot of people working full time as well, and they're going, having to kind of go and put coaching sessions on, organise kind of away trips wherever, like it's a difficult ask. And I think, like Ger says, that's when the FAI need to realise this and maybe just do a little bit more. For me, it's like, I don't think, it's quite obvious to me that they don't really care about, like, they say they do and this and that, but the proof is in the pudding. Like, there's no real advertisement in the league as well. Like, nobody knows really any of the players, bar the Dundalk lads who have done really well in Europe. Like, there's no, like, you walk along the street, like, there's not many And I'm not saying like they're going to be every like Premier League players mm. but you need to have a little bit more like, oh, there's such and such playing there. Like, you need to create that for young kids because they see stuff on the telly. Like, that's why there's so many young kids probably not going to the games, and you need to create that more of a feeling like these people are kind of not superstars, but they're kind of people to look up, that's where they want to aspire to. Because the way it is now, they've nothing to aspire to because they don't see them around anywhere. At least if they see them kind of a bit more highlight shows or ever a bit more publicity about it, then they might say, oh, I wouldn't mind doing that. But at the moment, it's just not good enough from in my opinion.
We signed a guy from the Dutch second division, Jordy Balk, in the summer. He was playing with FC Os, I think it is, and when he was over, I was talking to him, and just until he found his feet, I was bringing him training and different things, and we were speaking about how well the players in the Dutch second division be known, and he said, listen, they're known, they're people, fans, kids walking up following them home, newspapers want their articles, and there just seems to be driven by the sense of football. Like, you look, it's Gaelic season now, which is fine, and it's part of our culture in this country. But if we got even half of what the Gaelic people can get in, and maybe we need to take lessons from how Leinster have redirected over the last decade, of how they have turned their, you know, kind of small rugby brand into a major brand now. And I was only listening to an interview yesterday, can't remember who it was that was talking, but he was saying that Leinster are probably the most strongest team in the Northern Hemisphere at this moment in time. And you're probably looking and saying, can we then take little bits from that, the way the boxing done it for the Olympics, and shove that towards the league as a whole? Not just one team, shove it towards the league as a whole.
Well, we've had, and there's numerous tweets and texts coming into my left here just saying marketing, 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 marketing.
Just wrote down, that's what I've written down, marketing.
But like, where do you begin? I know Stephen's pointed out that essentially you have to pick players, but you can't necessarily pick randomers from the Finn Harris midfield and go, here you go, here's somebody that you should care about. It's trying to build
all together. Yeah. You need to have something in place, like, for example, the show that they put on, the highlight show, it's on at a time where I think they're changing, but it's on at 11:30 of a Monday night. Who's going to stay up and watch football at that time?
They've now, to be fair to them, they've changed it online where you can watch it live. I think it's 6:30. But like, again, yeah, who's in front of the computer?
Save my Wi-Fi.
Yeah,
true. It's not that long. You mentioned marketing. It's not that long where actually the FAI and the local councils were paying for each club to have a full-time marketing officer. Mm. So every 20 or 22 league clubs, as it were.
When was that?
It's only about
2009, it was 70 years ago. There, yeah.
And then the FAI got a bit of financial difficulties, and there were cutbacks across the board. And basically, in terms of the club and the marketing, well, organise your own marketing officer. Mm. Even the FAI's marketing department about the League of Ireland, if you were to sort of make a phone call, it could be well before you go, you know, it's not that extensive, the FAI's marketing arm for the league. And it does need marketing, because rugby, you hit the nail on the head, has been marketed hugely in the last 10, 15 years. There's this sort of brand of Leinster rugby. I'm not so sure how high the League of Ireland can go, because I've been watching it for a long time. Premier League is still big, or the old English First Division. I mean, if you were to ask newspaper editors what sells newspapers, you know, what do your listeners listen to? Certainly in the Dublin area, it's Dublin GAA, it's Premier League, and it's the Irish National Football Team. And then after that, then you have your next layer, boxing at the Olympics. You'd have a bit of rugby. You'd have, Olympics is big when it comes around. League of Ireland has a bit of horse racing, Cheltenham, so on. League of Ireland is a bit of a niche sport. It needs to sort of shed that image. Getting to shed it is difficult. But I've been to cup finals, and Jared, maybe Stephen, hopefully you'll get to play in the Aviva, the cup final. You get 25,000-26,000 in the cup final, and you suddenly realise, hang on, there's an event here. Yeah. People buy into this. Yeah. It's, can you get that sort of level of crowd, that sort of level of, you know, PR on
Philip,
a more consistent
basis?
Do
you not think then we can go beyond the FAI and say, let's go to government level? Like, how much money? I know times are difficult at the moment, and obviously the housing thing and stuff like that is quite prominent, and of course that would take, you know, front page. But could we not say, like, could we not go as 20 clubs and go into the FAI and say, right, let's come up with a proposal and go to government level, let's get some sort of funding from government level?
The FAI, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, we could be driving it, like, from the club's perspective, because listen,
how much communication is there, for instance, between, I know you're saying that the clubs have been working almost as a separate entity to the league, they've almost been talking amongst themselves, because from above the FAI
PCA,
there is not necessarily any guidance. How closely is the dialogue there, and how close is the dialogue between then the clubs and the FAI at the moment?
I don't know, to be honest with you, and I'm not sitting on the fence there when I say that. I don't know, because I wouldn't be privy to a lot of the discussions that go on. But right, from a sense of, like, listen, when this report came out, Conroy Report, maybe, if you're going in to do a kind of overview of someone's workplace, surely you talk to the employees. surely you go and speak to the employees. They could have spoke to the 20 captain to say, right, go get feedback from your players, come and meet us. They didn't. They didn't speak to us. They didn't do nothing like that at all at the time. And don't get me wrong, there were some good points in it, but there's some points where you're just absolutely laughing and saying, has this guy even got a remote idea of how the league works? And listen, I don't know what the relationship is like. Obviously, there's a lot of decisions made. Like the 10-team league, I think we might have been one of the clubs that voted for it. I certainly wouldn't have been voting for it if it came to me personally, because we should be looking to making 20 strong teams, not just 10 strong teams, because we seem to kind of forget about the teams. You know, I know Stephen Henderson would have been quite vocal on social media and stuff like that, but all the work and effort that he would have put in to try and meet sponsors, to get budgets in, to get players, to do all that type of hard work, then to try and sit down,
like,
you know,
sticking two fingers up at him.
Yeah,
but it's
January this announced as well, Stephen. He's planned for a budget, and all of a sudden it's like, well, am I going to get promoted in the top with Waterford's budget and Longford's budget and Shelbourne's budget? No. So what do you do?
It's time. The time was just. I couldn't believe it. I was just like, I would have been totally. I'd be more like, Chair, the more teams, the better. I think when the less amount, and I understand the kind of pros a little bit, what way do you reckon in getting the better teams in, probably create more kind of crowds at the games and all, but at the same time, from the outside looking in, like, I don't know, a 10-team league, it just...
If you're creating a secondary level in what people already view as a secondary product, it doesn't necessarily reflect well on those that are left in it.
But how many times have we heard, scrap the first division? You can't scrap the first division. What are you supposed to do? Do we go for one league? Maybe. Is there relegation? I don't know the rules. I'm sure there's rules and stuff around that. But I don't think we can just go and let's start wiping three or four teams out. Mm. We have a product. It's not marketed right. We know that. I think everyone hits the nail on the head there. But does players come over from England who are in the lower leagues in England, that I would say, like, since I've swapped roles now and gone into this, my email does be absolutely hopping every day with players who have been released by clubs that want to come in on trial and want to come over and play, because I'm sure Stephen will know more about it. It's an absolute rat race in the UK. You know, it's an absolute rat race. There's thousands and thousands of players that haven't got contracts, you know.
We've had another goal at the Etihad, on top of that sending off from Sadio Mane a little bit earlier on. Manchester City taking on Liverpool, coming up on an error play. Here's Darren Stanich.
Manchester City 3, Liverpool 0. Aguero beating the offside trap once more, and he played in Jesus, who couldn't miss. Open goal for him. It's Man City 3, Liverpool 0.
Finally, he's moved on to Jesus instead of Jesus. Thank you for that, Darren. We'll keep you updated as the game progresses. We were talking about, I suppose, planning comes into a lot of this, and in terms of budgetary planning, you touched on it there. I mean, you can't necessarily legislate for when you find out in January that you're actually going to have a 10-team first division and you're not going to get out of the 10-team Premier Division, you're not going to get out of the first. And you then see, I mean, was looking back on quotes surrounding John Delaney when he was talking about basically the development of the game in the country. He was saying back in May, this is before the AGM in July, when they announced that their debt was down to 40 million. He was saying that they'll have to contemplate their options, and admits that Ireland's attempt to qualify for the World Cup could influence their choice. He said at the time, the decision the association will make, and I think it'll probably be the first quarter of next year, is 2018, will bring the debt down to zero, or we'll use the funds to further develop the game. When you're in that position whereby it's an either develop the game or service the debt, you kind of see the position that the league finds itself in, and then the position that the national team finds itself in terms of just being a fundraiser for everything else.
Yeah, there's no straightforward solution to this. Like, obviously people are aware, but I think the League of Ireland just needs a little bit more help. It's like they say this, but at the same time I still think, like, John Delaney can do more. I think he comes out and speaks and they do this report, but to me that's just them making it look like they're caring, whereas I don't think they really care about the league. I use it no more about it than me, because I'm only back a couple of years, but to me it looks like the League of Ireland is, I've heard kind of the problem child a few times, that was a quote, but that's to me what it seems to be for the FAI, and it just shouldn't be like that.
Is that a worrying thing, Philip, when you see that a quote like that from Delaney back in May, saying that, you know, he has to see how things will go, otherwise it'll be servicing debt or looking after the league?
I would answer that. Why is there debt in the first place? Why has there been so much debt in Irish football for the last 8 years? You know, answering a postcard to Abbottstown. I mean, why do we owe 40, 50, 60 million? You know? I mean, if I was in charge of business and I owed that money, I don't think I'd still be in the business.
You see that with football clubs over in England. There's a certain amount of debt whereby you go beyond and you're still operational. Like, you look at the amount of debt that Manchester United is servicing, and yet you're still able to splash out 150 million quid on a player. You know, There's certain financial levels that we operate on that me and you, you know.
But it would not make better sense if we actually didn't have any debt. And then, and therefore, you could actually provide structures across the board for League of Ireland clubs and junior clubs.
But they'll point towards needing that stadium in place and needing to pay for the Aviva and needing everything that surrounded that have as a focal point for Irish football.
Well, we go back there and we look at the funding of that stadium. That's another issue. But ever since that stadium has opened, it's crippled Irish football with debt. And that debt... is the debt from that stadium is being used. Every penny comes into Irish football through the Irish national team, which is a big that's the machine that drives the financial engine of the FAI. And all the money coming in through that is being used to service the debt. And the League of Ireland is having to play second fiddle or third fiddle. And then further on down in the ranks, don't get me going, I'm a junior player, facilities down there are non-existent. Mm. Anyway, go back to one point there. Jerry was just saying there, at the moment there are big talks going on because the participation agreement is up for renewal at the end of this year. This is the last one of it. So this is where the FAI and the club sit down and they agree, we're going to go forward, here's our plan, here's our contract, you sign up for this and you agree to abide by it. Maybe it's time for the clubs to say, hang on, we're going to do our own thing. That agreement is now over, we've done it. Let's see what we can do ourselves. The PCR there, the Premier Clubs Alliance, they might decide to do their own thing. This could be the time to jump over the cliff and see where it takes you. I certainly would like to see a sponsorship. I remember Declan Conroy, he did the report. He spoke to me. He should have spoken to you and Stephen as well. And I just made a point to him. I'd love to have seen a title sponsor for the League of Ireland and the FAI Cup together and with €1 million. €1 million. This is it. Say, win the league and you get €500,000 from the sponsor. Win the FAI Cup, you get another €500,000. Big headlines, publicity. Get people out. Get people talking about the League of Ireland.
It would make you wonder how much effort has been put into.
Do you know how much money is in for winning the league?
It's 300,000+, isn't it?
No, it's
less now.
It's 200, is it?
Yeah,
100. The FAI Cup is 50.
It's 100,000 to win the league, but you don't get it because
you owe money.
Your fines are taken out, and then I think it's 20,000 to apply for the league to get in.
It's actually laughable.
I think you come out with about 60,000. No, I could be wrong.
You made your bus fare.
Because when we won it in 2003, it was 100,000. Now, I think it might be gone up because I think the betting thing...
The track champ deal.
Yeah, track champ deal might be in it, I think.
But betting in football, not too keen on that. I think that sends out a wrong image. Yeah. Anyway, that's beyond thought. Are we going to talk about the Irish football team?
Yeah, we are. Because that point of planning and that point of essentially the national team being a fundraiser for everything else in Irish football, that's the situation that we find ourselves in now, whereby people are complaining about the lack of good football on a national football team level and possibly not qualifying for a World Cup, and yet the qualification for the Euros and the qualification for the World Cup to the FAI, not to the management, is everything. It's absolutely everything. When you look at, and I was looking at the breakdown, the prize money here for 2018, I mean, you get $2 million, whatever that will work out in Euros, for qualifying for the actual tournament itself. Mm. And then if you get to the last 16, that's 10 million. And then if you get to the group stages, you get beyond the group stages, 10 million. Another 2 million on top of that for the last 16. 18 million again for the quarterfinals, and on and on and on. We might go, but I don't think we necessarily might dream in Irish terms of that. Yeah. But that shows you the money that they're depending on should they get to a World Cup. And if they don't get that, then they're not back into the position whereby they're planning again just to qualify for the Euros and trying to work that way. There is no... get a bunch of 22-year-olds blooded. Let's work towards having a decent team 3, 4, 5, 6 years down the line.
Yeah, there's no short fix, because if it's a very valid point there, because, and the Euros, by the way, were more than qualifying for the World Cup. For a lot, it's easier to get to the Euros, 24 teams as opposed to 13/14 for the World Cup. And UEFA pay, I think the FAI got over 11 million last year, and they qualified for the last 2 Euros. That's great money. It's huge money.
But the point that money has gone on.
A lot of it goes to bonuses for the managers and the players, and also the costs of the actual tournament itself. And then what's left has to service this debt, which we still have from the Aviva. But you're right. I mean, the FAI do say it's not imperative that they qualify for major tournaments every year, but actually every 2 years, actually it is.
When you see that disconnect of how everything else is set up, what Rude Doctor will put in place for underage levels and for youth systems in Irish football, especially in the national team level, to see it all disregarded as soon as you get to the Aviva Stadium or getting an away trip to Georgia or wherever it may be, it all goes out the window, because ultimately the 3 points is the key.
Ultimately, yes, it is. Ultimately, it's all about the international team. The international team is going well. Everything else will follow in its wake and will just...
But that's not true, is it?
Well, when was Irish football at its best? If you go back to 88, 1994, you know, that's when Irish football, you know, every Irish football was recognisable, you know, and everyone wanted to be associated with Irish football. Senior team goes well. It does pull in commercial revenue. It does pull in big attendances. There's TV deals as well. Senior team, success of the senior team is vital for the knock-on effect to elsewhere. But the senior team isn't going well. The FAI still has to do its business in terms of looking after the other elements of the so-called family, which is League of Ireland, which is schoolboy football, which is junior football, and colleges, and women's football, and all that. So there's a lot of demands on the FAI. I'm not so sure that I think maybe too much emphasis put on the senior international team. I'd love to see. We're coming to a crossroads in Irish football here, not just League of Ireland with this. Where did the League of Ireland clubs go from here? But in terms of, you know, what is the ultimate aim for Irish football? What do we? What
well,
do
it's
we
all
want?
Married together then.
It all goes back to the senior team. That's why we're going to talk about the senior team now. You know, if we were going to the World Cup now, I think we'd all be on a high, and we could talk about what that would bring, not just for the senior international team, what impact it could have on the League of Ireland and juniors and women and schoolboys. And it's a question of joining that. And we may not be going there. And I think if we're not going to go there, it could be a very turbulent 2 years for the senior team, and also turbulent 2 years for all levels of Irish football.
I just don't think there's any long-term goal, even with the senior national team at the moment. It's like, right, and part of me can kind of understand that, like you mentioned, it's so important to qualify for these tournaments. People say, are we, like, I've heard that one about, can we get in bed to kind of younger squad to get to prepare themselves for further down the line? But the likes of Martin O'Neill, Roy Keane, whoever's in charge of the team at the moment, it's all about result. It's a results kind of, they need to qualify now. They can't be thinking like 2 years. They might be in the job in 2 years' time. Mm. So, like, I was looking at the team there the other night, and I was like, we didn't play great in the both games, but it was worrying for me because I'm thinking it's an aging team, and you're thinking what's coming in behind them. And it's not as if the management in place at the moment are the type to kind of they don't naturally push younger people into the group to integrate them and kind of get used to that experience. So it's very worrying, because it does look like we're not going to qualify now, and it could be like you said, a long few years ahead for the national team.
We'll get on to last Tuesday and last Saturday in particular, and what may come next for the Republic of Ireland with our guests Gerard O'Brien, Stephen Elliott and Philip Quinn after this very short break. We were talking before the break about the Republic of Ireland team and our hopes for qualification for World Cup 2018 in Russia. 53106 is our text number for 30 cent if you want to get involved. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. Gerry, I'll turn to you first. Your expectations for going into those games with Georgia away and Serbia at home over the past week or so would have been, in terms of points tally?
Yeah, toy. Listen, I would have taken 4.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, we've struggled in Georgia the last few times, if I'm not mistaken. Philip will probably tell me. I think Aidan McGeady got a last second winner.
We actually beat them every match, but nearly always by one goal.
Yeah, yeah. And we only beat them, remember, 1-0 at home. I think Coleman's literally
bundled it in.
And,
as well.
And they were very good first half until we got the grips in the second half against them. Listen, I'm not saying that they're, you know, Spain or Brazil, but
we were owed one, is the word I kept seeing in the weekend leading up to that game.
As fans, we tend to go overboard when we're doing well, and we tend to go crazy when, you know, stuff goes bad. I think the big thing for me was just the performance levels. It looked like that. I can't imagine Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane sent them out to just play long ball football for the whole game. Like, we bypassed the midfield. The distances between the midfield and the defence was huge. The distances between Shane Long, who was unbelievably isolated. If you're going to play that way, at least put a second striker up there to play off him. And at home, it was better against Serbia. We were a little bit more energetic, I thought. You know, certainly first half, there was an okay. We had a goal disallowed, and there seemed to be a little buzz around the place. And going in at half-time, I said, okay, this game is here for the taking for us. We unfortunately switched off. We made a bit of an error at the back. We've conceded a soft goal from our point of view. And I was more disappointed with the last 20 minutes of that than the 90 minutes against Georgia.
You say we possibly go overboard, obviously, when we qualify, and that's fair enough, that's bound to happen, and we also do when we lose. Has the reaction to the last two games been justified? Because it's been an overwhelmingly negative one, especially in terms of tactics.
Yeah, I think so. Listen, the performance against Georgia was poor. I think everyone looks and says that, oh, well, why can't we play this type of football? I don't think let's not say we're not built to play this type of football, but we have to find a happy medium somewhere. Because we need to play to our strengths. And if you have a centre-forward up front like Shane Long, who can run channels and work centre-halves and, you know, very good in the air and cause problems. Listen, Shane's not fantastic at bringing the ball into play. Balls, you don't know, we're bouncing off him. Things can break down off us. But we need to play to our strengths. And that's up to the management team to be able to find that. And if you look at what Northern Ireland have, you can't tell me that they have a better group of players than what we have. But they seem to have an environment at the moment with Michael O'Neill, and it's working for them. Us at the moment, we started off great. We had a fantastic win away in Austria. I think everyone thought, okay, next 4 games, if we can just pick up some points with 2 kind of mediocre draws at home. We were poor against Wales. We didn't really overly perform against Austria, who again I thought were there for the taking. And now we've picked up 3 points from a possible 12.
Is the worry, we've seen obviously Northern Ireland, they beat the Czechs 2-0 at home. I think the possession stats in terms of that one, they weren't necessarily all that favourable in terms of the North, but they were able to pick off their chances and contain the checks as best they could. And as you mentioned, almost play to their strengths a little bit. With O'Neill and Ireland, the one recurring thing that comes back is we keep seeing this long ball football. And in terms of international weeks, we often see the better game come from Ireland in terms of the second game. Whether the first game has been a letdown or not, the second game, when they've actually got to work less as a group, actually ends up being the better team performance. So that would make you wonder what they're doing in the lead up to the first game.
Yeah, I just think...
Especially in terms of tactics.
Yeah, well, the Georgia game, for me, right, obviously... Georgia are no mugs. Like they're decent technically.
I don't think anybody here is expecting. No, but anybody listening is expecting a 4-0 win.
No, same time, like the Georgia, right? They're technically good players, but I don't think they're massively better technically than what we have. And I think the way we set up in that game was disappointing for me. It was the way we lost the game. Or sorry, we drew the game, but it felt like a loss. It was watching the game, and you didn't expect us to do anything in the game, and you're sitting there thinking, okay. Well, I think we got away. I think we've been getting away with murder this campaign, to be honest with you. I think we're probably even lucky to still be in. We're half a show. I don't think, like, we've been, like, even the Wales game. I'll go back to the Wales game. We went up a man, and our management on the pitch at times was poor. Our decision making was poor when we had the, we haven't used the extra man well. And whether that's to do with the players or with the management on the side, directing the players, the substitutions they make, I think there's been mistakes made. And I'm not turning around saying Martin O'Neill's a poor manager or Roy Keane's. I think Roy Keane's a good manager. I've played underneath him, but at the same time,
he steals your phone number, is basically what you're saying.
But no, but like, you're watching the game and you're thinking, like, even the Serbian game the other night, right? People say, oh, it was a good performance, it was probably our best performance of the group, but ultimately we lost the game. So yeah, it's a bit of a head scratch. You're sitting there going, right, we played well, but we still kind of, we have to realise we are what we are. Like this, yeah, the Serbian team, I think, played within themselves the other night. I think they kind of set back, and they only needed to draw that game.
And in Belgrade just over a year ago.
Well, they were missing a few players then, and we were lucky. We got away with a point that day, which we definitely didn't deserve, because they played us off the park for the majority of that game as well. But like, even the other night, we went up a man extra, and the decision making on the pitch was crazy. There was no leader on the pitch to say, like, listen, this is how we're going to do. There was bodies, like James McLean was going picking the ball up off our back four, like, and you're watching him in that position, you're thinking, you don't want him on the pitch there. You want him further up the field, getting that fullbacks, crossing the ball in for the big lads we had on the pitch at the time, like Darren Murphy, who'd come on, Shane Long, who looked tired, I thought, in the Serbian game, which, to be honest with you,
plus
he ran around like
the arse fly.
Exactly, yeah, on the Saturday without touching the ball.
I think that's what I was emphasizing to say. I think that last 20 minutes against Serbia over this course of two games was the most disappointing for me, because I'm looking at, we brought on two young lads who are but like, James is going and getting the ball, and James is picking the ball up centrally, and one of them two is out wide trying to take on a fullback. Like, there's no width, you're playing against 10 men. And as Stephen says, whether somebody on the pitch needs to grab that by the scruff of the neck and say, listen, but we've no John O'Shea anymore. Seamus Coleman's obviously injured, who's taken on the
missed
cap.
Him massively. We have. Like, it's so noticeable. It's
huge. Like, and in fairness to Cyrus, I know we were talking about outside. Listen, he got a little bit of criticism because of the decision making. James got criticism because of his decision making. But ultimately, panic set in. And it was like they were caught with rabbit in headlights. We'd no wit. And they were playing. They still stuck with that 3-4-3 formation. They just dropped the back then. And it was just, when they had that man sent off, we just didn't work the keeper.
Ken Early was writing in the Times in the wake of those two games, Philip, and he was saying that basically any international team, well, not any, but a team of a decent standing who puts in and has together a decent plan, especially in terms of how they set out for a game, will manage to succeed in the international game at the minute, just given the very nature of it, and given the nature of how teams work together in the short space of time that they might have to prepare. You get the sense that despite the number of days the Irish team might spend together, you struggle to pick and pinpoint a plan. In that team.
Yeah, you do a little bit. And I was interested to hear what Jerry said about the last 20 minutes against Serbia, because I would agree with him. I thought they were effectively down to 9 men because their centre half had done his hamstring. Yeah.
Went up top, didn't he?
And he went up top. And then they dragged him back and sort of put him on the edge of the penalty area. And what struck me there was that I was glad to see O'Neill give Callum O'Dowd a run. But I thought, where's Sean Maguire? Where's somebody a little bit different? Even Stephen Elliott in his prime, with all due respect, you know, a goal scorer. You know, we knocked the ball long for the last few minutes. We put Darren Murphy, but Shane Duffy came up for free kicks. We ended up having Long, Walters, Duffy and Murphy up in the penalty area, certain penalty area, and we'd no one outside the penalty area calling the shots.
But you're not thinking we didn't do either, Philip? Like, I was nearly expecting when Duffy went up, I was like, We didn't now put it up there, and they didn't. We worked it out.
And then we worked out why we should have got it in, and
we'd
vice versa.
We've no wide players. We've some midfielders out there.
There's a little bit of perspective needed as well, I think. And I don't want to be sort of. I'm not sort of saying that Martin O'Neill is blameless in this. I am concerned about the plan. I'd like Martin O'Neill to come in and sit down. Actually, what is actually his plan?
But he doesn't know. He doesn't owe you an explanation, as we found out.
But he doesn't. I'm not asking, but he'll.
Why should he tell you, Phil?
He'll give a good answer, but I'll end up saying what was he actually saying there at the end. But in all fairness, he spoke to us after the match, and I will say this: he was hurt. And we were in the dressing room after the game. I was in the dressing room outside the press room afterwards, and he was a little sort of Sunday newspaper huddle, and he was hurt. And he said that he takes things very much to heart in football. And at the age of 19, he played in the Irish Cup final for the Distillery. And he said he was the last to leave the dressing room. I'm always last to leave the dressing room, he said. And I'll be last to leave it tonight. He said, I'm thinking about it non-stop. He said this, and I've told the players, I'm going to pick yous up. I'm going to make sure we win the next two games. And we're going to do that. And it was actually kind of interesting, kind of soul sort of searching stuff. He certainly gave the distinct impression, and I believe was genuine, that was really, really hurting him. And I think he looked back on those two games, 1 point out of 6. Jared said 4 going into it. I kind of thought we might get 2. I thought it might have been 2 draws. The Georgia one, I'll just come back on that. And I know we played poorly, but I went through my notes. We had 6 goal chances in that game.
2 great ones at the end.
3 in the first half, 3 in the second.
But
and we didn't take them, Stephen.
That was the frustrating thing for me in that game, right? Yeah. I don't think we had a game plan that day. Well, to me, the game plan was just to sit back in our own box and play Shane up on his own and let them. But like you mentioned, we still had the best chances in the game, and but that's what had been happening, in my opinion, in the group game so far. We've been playing poorly and we've been winning games, and I think that was papering over certain cracks of how we were performing on the pitch. Like if we had won that game in Georgia, everybody would have come away, like you say, oh great, another win. Yeah. We're one game away from the world, and like you say, international football's like that. People tend to forget about things really quickly.
How often
football.
Have we played really well under Martin O'Neill then?
I can't. In the Euros against Italy.
I would have thought Germany at home was a good performance. We showed a lot of heart that night. They didn't batter us.
That's one of the cases in point, apparently.
Italy was good. Italy. I thought against France we played really well.
We played half against France, but that's the thing.
There is something there.
And we played well. There was quality on the pitch, moving the ball well. And you're thinking after the Euros, oh, maybe we're onto something here. And then we go, it's like, I don't know, it's like we've kind of gone backwards rather than forwards.
I think we're a group of players. We need to have Seamus fit. We need to have Robbie Brady for an all-cylinders. There's Jeff Hendrick playing well. These have now become the new Duffs and Keens, because they're the ones that we need to look to. And at the moment, from being in the stadium for the last few home games, Shane Duffy is kind of taking on the mantle. He's very vocal. I'm not saying he's technically the best player in the world, but he's played well
in the games defensively.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like he's won his headers and
you can hear him. He's talking, he's barking through the back line and stuff like that. And we need those. And what struck me the other day, this guy was walking off behind it and he's signalled to the bench. They've made 3 subs, Serbia. And Matic is dragging him on, saying, we're down to 10 men.
He didn't seem to know.
We've no more subs. Get on the pitch. And he's fighting with him. And I don't think we have those type of characters. Not that you need them, but you need some sort of
mentioned Matic there. In fairness, you have to remember who Ireland were playing during the night. They're playing the team with the likes of Matic, Kolarov, Ivanovic. These are lads that played Champions League football.
They had 4 Champions League players of this season. We had 4 championship players.
Well, there you
level.
Go. And that's what I'm saying.
A bit of perspective is needed.
Yeah,
we were counting
them
out. So, and even the Welsh team, you know, Ashley Williams, Everton, Gareth Bale, Real Madrid,
Aaron Ramsey, Arsenal.
Aaron Ramsey,
they're the Europa League, but they're in Europe.
Coming through at Liverpool.
Joe Allen at Liverpool at Stoke now.
Hennessy's in goal for Palace. All of a sudden, are we not punching above our weight, but are we where we should be? Are we touring the group? Because if you had us going at the last 2 games with all the fixtures, home to Moldova and away to Wales, that if you win both of them, you're more than likely get into a playoff. I think people would have taken her at the start. It's just how well our start has gone.
Robbie Savage said the other day that he'd only have Seamus Coleman in the Welsh team, nobody else. That's all he said. No one else is good enough. Is that
Neil Taylor is, who's he, Spurs? The left back, is he Spurs?
Taylor was at Swansea, he's dropped away from there. Villa.
Like, you know, so these guys have played in the Premier League. As you said, we're calling on guys who are coming out of the League of Ireland, or we're calling on guys who are only breaking through from Barnsley and Villa and other teams like
but
that.
But you mentioned the lads, McCarthy, Seamus Coleman. Seamus Coleman, I think, is a top class player. We don't have people like Robbie Keane, Damien Duff, players like that to call upon anyway. We just don't have that quality. I mean, we have to remember that as well. Like, we were very lucky to have lads like that in the team. John O'Shea playing at Man United. Do you know what I mean? We don't have players playing at these clubs anymore, and we have to remember that.
I did a survey before I came here, just a bit of homework. So, but in Euro 88, where it all began, if you like, for Ireland, and we went there, Liverpool won the English league that year, and we had 3 players in the English champions. We had Whelan, Houghton and Aldridge. Man United were second. We had three players from Man United's team in the squad. Celtic were a good team in 88. They won the double. And we had three players there. We had a player from Everton Arsenal. We had players from the top of England, and Celtic were probably a bit
but
stronger.
It's different, if it, even okay. the, it's a different years. Landscape, and you're looking at
it is,
and it's not necessarily just Irish players that have been affected by the change in that. I mean, that statistic that was rolled around when people talked about the Premier League reaching its 25th anniversary there the week was that there was only 13 foreign players, full stop, in the division. Now there was, I did a personal top myself on the day just to go, well, there surely wasn't 13, or wasn't Irish players included in that. I think we had like 48 there or thereabouts, maybe 49. Irish players in the top flight at clubs who got appearances that year.
When the,
that season.
That season, yeah. How many now?
Well, it's significantly less. We'll talk about the development and how, you know, we're next for the team in the next couple of moments. But there's been a fourth goal, would you imagine, at the Etihad's latest from this one, Darren Stanich.
Manchester City 4, Liverpool 0. A substitute, Leroy Sané, who beat the offside trap, played the ball out to the left-hand side to the overlapping forward Mendy. He sent it straight back in and a side foot into the near post. Goalkeeper beaten, Manchester City 4, Liverpool 0.
4 minutes to go in that one and it's all over. The 3 points are Manchester City's. It's a question of how many really at this stage. The question of bringing players through to the Ireland first team, let's call it, our senior squads, has kind of raised its head over the last while. There's talk now for the last couple of games we may see Scott Hogan parachuted in out of nowhere into the senior squad. But ultimately, it's these kind of parachutings that we need. Because you're looking at, with all due respect to Daryl Murphy, as we see Mignolet making another save from Aguero, Daryl Murphy is in his mid-30s now at this stage, and he is the second choice striker once Walters and Long perhaps are the reckoning. Then you've got David McGoldrick, who has, you know, done okay for Ipswich so far this season. But it's not just in terms of strikers. There seems to be a lack of desire to blood players in important games from Martin O'Neill. I was asking Kevin Kilbane this question on air. He seemed, because often you see O'Neill raising the point that, well, we can't blood them in a competitive international, because what if something happens to them and, you know, then, you know, it might impinge on their confidence and they might, you know, die a death after that in terms of international football. But Kevin himself had a rotten first 45 minutes in Iceland.
I remember he was taken off.
Did all right afterwards, won about 300 caps after that, thereabouts. We've seen the last week, Ben Woodburn, 17 years of age, playing and scoring at international level for Wales. You kind of wonder why there isn't the same openness, let's call it, to bringing in younger players. I'm not just talking about 17-year-olds. 22, 23, 24. You're still talking about inexperience in Irish terms, which can't be right.
Are they good enough? That's the question. On one hand, we don't know because we haven't seen them. But on the other hand, you're sort of saying, well, what level are they playing at? Like, we're talking about bringing in Scott Hogan. Now, me and Stephen were speaking about it outside and he might give you his opinion on it now in a minute. But it's like, our underage teams have actually done all right at tournaments. Like, I remember Paul Doolan's team went to the Euros and under-19s maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I think Egan might have been playing in that team and a couple of others. Like, are these the guys that need, like, who was our centre-forward at that time? Who was our right-winger? Like, I was only speaking to one of the members of the under-21 international team. They were in Azerbaijan this week and he was running through the team and I'm saying, who's next to make the step up? Like, who's ready to come in through? And he's saying, I don't know, like Rice played in midfield, he's playing left side of centre back for West Ham. He's sort of saying maybe him, because he's only had to being trucked in by West Ham. There's not much else that he could say. He's definitely going to go in and play. Like, Manning scored a couple of goals, he's playing for QPR in the Championship. Is he ready? His opinion was, I don't think so. But then again, we haven't seen them to be able to see, can they make that step?
We had them friendlies. Remember a couple of friendlies there in America? We played Mexico.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I think he played a few of the kind
he did,
of.
Yeah.
And by all means, it wasn't the greatest performance. And I know you can't judge players on one game, especially when they're all thrown in together like that. And it, go back to game plans, it didn't look like they had a game plan that day either. Like, but the Mexicans were a strong team. So if you're going to judge players off little games like that, it's very difficult. If they don't, like, in fairness to the management, if you put them in and they play in the game and they don't kind of perform to a level, then it's very difficult when you have in your mind, like, this is my group of players, you need to do something special to kind of break in. But in fairness, we need to start looking a little bit further afield. I know you mentioned Hogan. To me, I'd rather see Seanie Maguire in the team. I know Hogan scored it because Seanie Maguire's, he's like,
well, why not have both of them in around the squad? I mean, the one that had me scratching my head last week is when that squad was cut from, and obviously it needs to be from 39, 40 players down to, I think, a more manageable 25. But still in all, we had very paltry striking options. There was four lads there, and one of them, it was John Walters, who was
injured,
working on night and day to get him fit.
But, like, this is the thing, you, like, look at the squad and you've got like 2-3 centre-halves sitting on the bench. And listen, we're all due respect to these lads. Right, good. Martin O'Neill's very loyal, keeping him in the squad. He likes his group to be very close. He likes to have the same group. But you need options. Like, you, like, who's to say that the other night, right, you're playing against Serbia. I don't know whether Sean Maguire is ready for international football, but like, why not give him 10 minutes at the end? You know, and get used to the balls are going in the box. He's, the goal doesn't move, whether you're playing kind of wherever level you're at. He's full of confidence. He's out there getting his move away to Preston. Then why not have him in there, even on the bench? You know what I mean?
I couldn't agree with you more, Stephen. I think you have to go back here. Martin O'Neill is a very conservative manager, and he's a pragmatic manager, and he doesn't change for the sake of change. He's very reluctant to change. He's been very loyal to players. Some of his team selections, he throws in an odd curveball. But one thing he hasn't done, he hasn't gambled hugely, and he could have gambled by keeping Sean Maguire in the squad, and he didn't. He chose not to. And left himself open to criticism.
Wouldn't it be hard to keep him in the squad?
No. Keeping him in the squad is no.
But in the squad, having him around, for he said, yeah, he thought it was an interesting thing. When he announced the squad, he said, well, he saw Maguire in the cup final last year, he felt he wasn't good enough. But he wasn't good enough. That's fair enough. Maguire did bundle home a last minute winner in the cup final.
Knows it shows how poor the goal is. That was his frame of reference until the game against Dundalk.
Then he saw him against Dundalk, and he said he was much better, and he got his move to Preston. Now, if he's playing in the Championship...
The magic plane.
Well, we spoke to Darren Randolph last week, and he said that he played against Maguire, and he said he's a very good player. He said he had to make a really good shot.
Got man of the match in that game against Middlesbrough.
So, the players themselves know what Maguire's like, and O'Neill showed his conservatism there. I think he should have brought him in, had him around the squad, may not play him against Georgia. There's been another goal.
5-0 in the pick of the bunch for Manchester City. Leroy Sané.
Sané, wow.
But Philip, we don't need to blood 5 or 6 in any one game.
No, but it's
about blood and warning.
And if O'Neill had seen him, Gerard, I think, for 4 or 5 days in training before George, he might have said, hang on, this guy's maybe closer to being it than I thought.
Yeah.
And certainly would have given us an option. A fox in the box.
Who else have we got, though?
But Daryl Horgan was on the bench today. He's an out-and-out wide player, and I played against him. And I'll tell you, he would give any fullback at international level or League of Ireland level or Championship level problems, because he plays on the left, he's right footed, all he needed to get down was, like, we were expecting Callum O'Dowd to go by a fullback the other day. Like, he plays for Bristol City, he's the same level as Daryl, so why not throw Daryl on, who's an actual wide player?
As someone who's actually played international football, we'll turn to the man in the middle. Look, what's that step up into the squad like? Like, is there a great deal of trepidation as you're walking into, say, Port Marnock Hotel that morning, or you're coming through the airport? Like, are you, this is probably a person by person. Yeah. Are you bricking it? Are you thinking, how am I going to fit in here?
I'll be honest, when I broke into the national team, I was still very young, and I was like, I don't know.
Cocksure.
Yeah, you just go with the flow. For me, it was the natural progression for me. I was doing well at Sunderland, scoring goals. I'd played, I don't know how many games. I've scored in every game I played for the 21. So for me, the next progression was me to go and do that. And after one session, I was like, wow, this is a big step up. Like, I noticed the step up. It's kind of, everything's bang sharp at it. And you need a couple of kind of, I don't know, get-togethers to kind of get used to the speed of how things are. Everything, like, to kind of staying in the hotel for, like, a week and a half, you know what I mean, sitting in the hotel room. Not, like, I know you do that on away trips, but it's very different. Yeah, it's not just the games. It's a whole kind of process of being in the squad. And for me, I look back, I was very young, so I didn't really think about it too much. I was just like, right, and I obviously, when I play the game, you're nervous and that, but the adrenaline of playing, like, I go back to say my the adrenaline for me when I make my international debut, it was the best moment of my life, like, because it's something you dream about as a kid. And I think, like, see Sean Maguire, you see the way he is, he's a passionate Irish kid, he's kind of, you see, I just think there's something about, like, I'm not saying nothing against Sean Hogan, fair enough. Like, Scott Hogan, whatever his name is. But that's what it's like for me. I tried to give him a little bit of Irishness there, giving him an Irish name. Like, but more on it, it's like, I hate all that humming and hawing. Like, and listen, I've nothing against, like, this discussion's been loads of times, where about, oh, do I want to play for Ireland? But it's like, we're wondering if he wants to play for Ireland. Do you know what I mean? That doesn't sit right with me. Fair enough, if you're English and you're brought up in the Irish way and you've played, then yeah, you're more than welcome. You deserve it. But, like, I would have Sean Maguire a million times ahead of him, just because of I think he'd have more of a heart to go out there, and it means so much more to him than somebody else. And I think that's what we were missing from the squad the other night. And I think the adrenaline alone would have been enough for him to perform.
Sure.
Yeah, I agree. The thing about it is, I said previously that no player... Not that I don't think any League of Ireland players can be in the squad regularly. I think they do need to go play at a higher level. And Sean has done that. He's not gone in there, and he's not there only, he's only there a wet day, but he's gone in and he's made a good impression at Preston. And to have him in, like, this is probably going to be a couple of the boys' last campaigns. So we need a new generation coming through, and he's probably, definitely from playing against him, he's probably the next best that I can see anyway out there.
It's little things like that. It's like I can absolutely forgive not having Sean Maguire start either away to Georgia or home to Serbia. I can 100% forgive him not even being on the bench. It's having young players, and it's not just without wanting to single him out. It's having those younger players and transitioning them into maybe having those the players that are cut from the 39 in and around the senior squad. I mean, there is a sense that Gary Rogers has more international experience now from training with the senior squad over the past
year.
That's
an important part of it. Yeah. Like, I mean, you need to get you, like, he needs to, Sean Maguire, right? He's been playing League of Ireland. He needs to be used to kind of hanging around, not hanging around, just being in the company of all these like kind of regular household names. Because although they're only, it's still when you're a player and you go in. Like, I remember when I went in, there was like Robbie Keane, Damien Duff Reichen, Kevin Caban, Kenny, all these lads, Shea Given, that are like legends in my eyes, who I supported growing up. And I had to get used to being in that kind of
environment
with them, because it's a bit kind of like, oh wow,
am I
allowed to speak, and kind of you need to kind of get build yourself up into that group. And that's what having him in the environment will achieve. And for me, not having him in that was, in my opinion, the wrong decision, because you're putting players in there who've been part of the group, yet they know the group, but they're not gonna do anything on the pitch for us. You know what I mean? There's 7 or 8 players who you know aren't gonna enter the pitch no matter what.
Well, and I mean, you mentioned the 3 centre-halves in the defence.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm only a junior manager at a very low level, but your back five generally didn't change.
No.
You know,
no.
And O'Neill already changed his back five. You bring players in who can make a difference if you're chasing a goal. You generally have a midfielder, a wide player, or a forward who'll come in.
You don't need 3 centre-halves.
It'll be very interesting to see now, and looking forward. O'Neill's got 2 games, possibly, to save the World Cup campaign and maybe stay on as Irish manager. What will he do? What squad will he bring?
Is he not been offering
a new contract? Well, there's the rumours. Well,
yeah.
The rumour is, but I think much will be decided on how it goes against Moldova and against Wales.
Things can change very quickly.
They can change very, if for example, we didn't well against Moldova, the mood of the crowd at the Aviva would certainly influence the FAI. But I think we should be able to beat Moldova. But O'Neill now has, and he left the Aviva on Tuesday night, and he said he was going to do everything in his power. He's going to think really, really hard about what happened the last week and do his best to lift the players and get things right for the next 2 games. Interesting to see then, will he change his squad? Will he change his tactical approach? Will he have a plan that we're not quite aware of?
If he's talking about lifting them, he's talking about lifting what's already there. He's not going to presumably bring in 2-3 players.
I think O'Neill's more bothered about what the public persona think of him rather than Ireland, in my opinion. I think he's more about what people think. Oh, how, like you say, you done that interview at the game, and I'm sure he was upset and angry, but I still think I wouldn't be 100% sure that was purely like totally true. I think he's tries to create something, and like he's very, very worried about how people see him, and he wants to be this kind of figure that is important and stuff. And I think, as I was saying, qualifying for the Euros last year, putting back up there as like one of the kind of so-called elite managers
in the shop window.
Yeah,
again.
And now he's thinking, right, I have 2 games to kind of get my name back, because it's gone down a little bit this campaign. He's got a couple of games now. If I can get 2 wins, even if now I'm back kind of right, okay, thanks very much, I tried my best, there you go, there's a squad with no young players coming through, I've done my bit, you know what I mean? And it's a bit of a problem for the next guy coming in.
Are we going to get 6 points out of these 2 games, sir?
We might need them. Really, like if Wales go to Georgia, like in fairness to Georgia, they've drawn with us, they've drawn with Austria.
We need them because of the other games, it looks like we're going to need them.
But yeah. Listen, can we get 6? Yeah, of course we can get 6. Anything can happen in that Wales game. I'd expect us to beat Moldova.
You like to think Moldova is a
home banker.
But you think, right, we win that game, and the big game's Cardiff. And for me, the Cardiff game's going to decide. We're going to probably be looking at other results as well. Even Wales will as well, because Wales are at right bottom. They're in second place.
Second place mightn't be good enough for them.
Exactly, yeah. So
they need 2 wins.
The most extraordinary scenario here is, and I was just in a bit of research, it could situate...
Your notes are something else, by the way.
Oh, they've been.
I have to point this out.
If Wales drop points against Georgia...
They're goose, big time.
And they could go into the last match against us knowing that even if they beat us, it's not enough.
They're only on 8, aren't they?
So if they drew, for example, against Georgia, they would be on 9 on this mini table, knowing the max they can get is 12. I think you only need 13.
Yeah,
and if they lost to Georgia, the most they can get actually then is actually 11.
The Wales-Georgia result doesn't really affect us, I don't think, looking at the other mini
the
table.
Overall, yeah.
I think we have to look, we've got to win both matches.
We've got to win both matches,
we become second, we'll have 13 points on the mini table, and that should be almost certainly enough to get us through.
We've done it in the past. We always seem to find a way, don't we?
We're like, the playoff kings.
This is what it always comes back to. We always find a way to end on a note of optimism.
I think Stephen's point is very interesting. Is Martin O'Neill here for the long haul, irrespective if the next two games go, say, okay, let's say we get a draw and a win, or win and a draw, whatever it is, and he finishes in third place, he might just say, you know what, I'm not really pushing your contract, maybe it's time for me to go.
I think he'd roar. Like, you know? Looking at it, in international managerial terms, especially from Irish, since Jack's departure, you seem to have this cycle whereby you get a couple of qualification campaigns, you'll have one good and possibly one bad and two good, and then you'll probably go. When there's a draw, whether you're in the finals or not then. And I would presume that whatever happens in July, Martin O'Neill won't be the Ireland manager after that, July of next year.
July of next year?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that could well be the case.
Yeah, I agree.
He certainly will go to the World Cup.
Yeah. He's not going to get out before that's a payday.
The only thing I'll say is, I don't think there's anyone clamouring to be given a new deal. I don't think there's anybody really...
It's pretty telling that.
Yeah. I don't think there's anyone saying, sack him, really. I think it's... taker, or like, you know, if he's given a new contract, I don't think there's going to be a huge uproar. If he's it's who's next to come in. Then I've seen, obviously, Stephen Kenny was mentioned this week. His traits in Europe last year will obviously pin him to the fore. I'd love to see us do what we done with Brian Kerr and give him a chance and give someone a fair chance.
What about Roy? What about Roy, Jerry? You and Stephen, you've played under Roy.
Well, Stephen,
you know, he's the right-hand man there. He's in the right position.
The thing is, I think Roy's in there. I'm not too sure how much him and Martin are on the same page there. For me, I can't see how, knowing both of their personalities, and speaking to a few people that are working, we're in the national team now, I don't know how much they're on the same wavelength at the moment. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. Like, Roy could be a great manager in his own right, but he stepped back a little bit from management. And I'd like to think he's learning a little bit from the mistakes he probably made when he was a manager. And who knows, he's still a young man in management terms. So
yeah, this role probably will suit him to a certain degree. Well, cheers, lads, for taking time out this Saturday afternoon to try and pick through all of this. Gerard O'Brien, Stephen Elliott and Philip Quinn.
Off the Ball on News Talk. In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.